Kia ora, and welcome to Talking Performance. I'm your host, Jay Carter, and in this podcast, I aim to connect with people to chat about performance and what it means to them in an effort to share some gold with our community. I aim to have guests on from various parts of the performance world, such as athletes, coaches, and business leaders, ordinary people who do extraordinary things. These sessions are recorded live on Facebook on the group page Talking Performance at 8 p.m. New Zealand time, if you'd like to watch the show live. If you enjoy the podcast, it would be great if you could share it with your friends and even leave us a review.
Hello, mate.
Jay.
How you doing? You good?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Just impressed with your technical ability to get that all up and running.
Yeah. Good. Hey, thanks for coming on.
Pleasure.
Good appreciate to be on. It. How's your holiday?
I've just got back a week ago now. My wife and I, Harriet, we went down the South Island in a camper van. So we certainly had a holiday. It was awesome. Yeah, we loved it. We flew into Christchurch. We made our way down the east coast and back up the west, catching up with heaps of people. So we didn't have to do too many continuous nights in the van.
Cause we'd
catch up with friends and they'd offer up a bed, which we'd kindly, happily accept. So, but we had a great time. Always wanted to do that trip at some point. When you get I think I've had two long-term injuries now, and both of them have been in the last 3 years. You've got to look for, some sort of silver lining, and that's doing something that you wouldn't normally get the chance to do during this time of year. So we, as soon as I knew I got out of the sling, got a bit of movement, wasn't in too much pain, we planned that trip, and really glad we did it. It was awesome.
Yeah, nice. I'd love to get one of those vans, and just cruise. It's sweet.
Yeah, I'd recommend it to anyone, man. We were blown away with sort of how much we packed in. I think because you sort of wake up, you park somewhere, wake up, and you're in that place, you check it out, move on. And I think it was after about the third day, we felt like we'd been going for about 5 days. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just managed to pack so much stuff, and we had a great time.
Yeah, nice.
Good for the relationship too, even in a confined space like that.
Yeah, it could be.
We had so many people message saying like, oh, I don't know how me and the wife would last in there. Or we're probably better than we are at home.
Probably harder on Harriet than it would be for you.
Yeah. Well, I won't throw her under the bus on this.
I guess we probably don't need too much of an intro, mate, but I'll do a very brief one. You've played for probably three of my favourite teams. Played for the All Blacks, the Chiefs, Bay of Plenty, four maybe, Tauranga Boys College. I guess the only gap in the resume made is Grierson Marist.
Oh, yeah. When I left school and moved over that way, I lived in the mountain. I had to try to find a club because my club side growing up was Riparaa. But yeah. Sort of an hour and a half, 40 minutes to training. So, and they're in second division. Yeah. And sort of needed to be playing Prem's rugby to try and push my case for a Steamers gig. Yeah. So, ended up going with Tauranga Sports. I don't think Gretton were playing Prem's rugby back then.
Right.
Otherwise,
otherwise, it's a no brainer, eh?
Yeah. but since then I've moved back to the Māori Riparaa Rugby Club. So I'm affiliated with them now. Yeah. I remember as a young fella looking up at the honours board at Riparaa, and there was a couple of guys who had trialled for the North Island team. I think there was a Māori All Black, but there's no one who had played for the All Blacks.
Yeah.
And just to now be able to go back there, have all the young kids who are probably in similar position to me look up and see someone from that rugby club, hopefully inspire them in that way somehow.
Yeah, 100%. Do you get back there very often? Because your family's still there, right? Or your mum and dad?
Yeah, mum and dad are still there. They're deer farmers in Riparaa. I don't see them ever moving. They've got a little holiday home in the mountain now, which is nice. We spend a bit more time if we're catching up sort of in the mountain rather than heading home. But I am heading back next weekend. There's a big club day where all the junior teams play, followed by the senior teams. So all the teams are playing in one area. Because growing up, we used to have to travel into Rotorua to play all our junior footy, and that's what they still do now. So, big day for the club. And again, I had an injury. Normally, I don't get the chance to do these things because it collides with games. So, really looking forward to that day.
Nice. I guess that injury bit leads on a little bit. There's a couple of things I want to touch on. One would be the work that goes on outside of probably what people perceive rugby players do, which, you know, go to the gym, train, and then play. I suspect there's a whole lot more work involved. And also at the moment, being injured, I guess what sort of things do you do or are you required to do in terms of your roles with Chiefs or the All Blacks?
It'd be tough to summarise. look, when you're a young fella coming into the team, it's not that – well, it is hard because it's new. It's not what, you know, you're getting – you're coming to grips with what it takes to be a professional. But as you progress, I reckon after the sort of 2 to 4 year mark for most guys, they've got a handle of what it's about, know what's required. But not so much anymore. Used to not be in many meetings. You know, what people probably don't realise is like the planning and the discussions and the meetings that go into to so much of our weeks. But when you end, particularly once you, if you transition into a leadership role, you have even more responsibility and more meetings. And you just spend a lot more time, even when you get home, you don't switch off as much. It's not like my day's done. You're always thinking about things and, I don't know, little areas that we could get an edge or do better, or reflecting on the day that's been. I'm like similar to what I suppose a lot of people might do for their jobs or when they're really invested in their work. But at the moment, the Chiefs have been in Aussie for, this is their third week now. So it hasn't been too much us boys at home can do. But normally, in the first few weeks when I was injured, I just sit in on those meetings and chip in where I could. I feel I've got like enough respect from the boys now that I'm happy to present in front of meetings even though I'm not playing. Whereas it used to be a case of, well, I can't really talk if I'm not asking the boys to go and do something if I'm not having the chance to pull on the jersey this weekend. So enjoyed helping out, and also enjoyed the positive part of being injured was I wasn't in so much of a rush at training for going, because sometimes our schedule's so sharp. You know, when people ask me what a day like, the best way I can explain it is to bring up the calendar on my phone. You know, that starts at 8:30 we've got this, at 9:45 we're doing this, and all the way breaks it all the way down to lunch, and then we have a couple of hours break for lunch. Because obviously if you're training, you've got to let your food settle. You can't just rip in. And then the best way is to show them on the phone. But when I got injured, because there wasn't much training for me to do, I really enjoyed sort of maybe connecting with players more, like having genuine chats that I wouldn't get the opportunity to do because I'm normally constant go, 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 or thinking about where I've got to be next.
Yeah. Do you see stuff differently when you're injured and watching, you know, like if you're reviewing a game, when you're injured and you've probably got a more global view than when you're actually playing, do you see stuff differently or do you pick up the same sort of cues?
I certainly noticed a few different things from actually watching the game live that I wouldn't normally see. Notice how slow some of the games are, like the amount of stoppages we're having for footy is frustrating me. Guys, if someone's injured, a winger's injured on the far side of the field, we're sort of stopping the line out on the other side, which never used to be the case. I think we can speed the game up a wee bit. But then, it's a trade-off because when you get into review on Monday, there's often things that if you've played, you can only chip in because of how it felt out there at the time.
Yeah.
But it's nice to, chip in with what I've seen and maybe challenge guys' thinking.
Yeah.
Just ask posing questions, But it was important, I think, once I got injured, not to, you know, try and carry on being the same leader that I was when I was playing, because that's actually not going to help the team because I wasn't going to be out on the field. It was more about, I suppose, trying to empower and encourage the other guys to step up and fill that void a wee bit. And they can't do that if I'm, being too dominant, I suppose.
Yeah. You know, when you see the when you're watching and the opposition score a try and you guys will get around and have a huddle and, like, I suspect a few of the key guys are talking, how accurate are those conversations? Like, do you ever review them and go, like, because, under emotion, when you're pissed off or getting frustrated, you say some stupid shit sometimes. I suspect that you guys are probably a little bit more advanced than that, but do you often reflect on, this is what was said here, this is what needed to be said, and is it different the next day?
Yeah, definitely reflect on those conversations. And so my thought process when we come into a huddle is always, I'm thinking in my head, like, what's the most important thing that needs to be delivered? Like, what's the single most important thing that's going to help us? And I'll be reflecting on, why are we under the sticks? Like, what's happened that's caused us to be here? Is it a one-off missed tackle? Is it consecutive penalties? It's normally something that's allowed them to gain momentum. It could be passive tackles, whatever it is. To work out whether that's worth addressing. Because if it's a one individual one-off tackle, it's not worth addressing to the whole team. That's a waste of time. So work out if that's important, and if it's not, then the message will normally be around what's next. What's the next thing we need to do and now, which is often the kickoff, or will be the kickoff. Where are we going to kick it to? What do we hope to achieve from there? And what can we expect from them? So, look, the less words, the better. The only time I'll probably really speak with too much emotion, or as if it's a lack of, like, attitude or desire or something like that, that deserves a rack up. If guys are putting in the effort, but it's more of a technical, tactical thing, there's no point speaking with emotion. It's more effective to speak calmly and clearly. Because too much emotion will just, you could ask the guys to repeat what you've said 10 seconds later and half of them won't even remember.
Yeah. That must be hard, though, to get rid of that emotion when your heart rate's going at 100 and I don't know what it gets up to in a match, but, 100 and whatever, and you're pissed off and you feel like you're putting the effort in. It must be hard to stay calm.
Not too bad. I think that sort of comes with experience a little bit. Learning that there's no point working yourself up over something like that. But it also depends on guys' personality a wee bit. We've certainly got guys who can fire up a wee bit easier than others. And that's okay too, because that's what makes them good rugby players, like their passion and their commitment. Yeah. So, if the time's right, it's okay to let one of them rip.
Yeah. Do you have any, apart from the what's important now and what's next, do you have any training on conflict? Because conflict's a good thing, right? Especially probably in your sport, where you need to have some honest conversations and you need to action quite quickly. Do you guys use any frameworks, or have you got any structures, or do you have training on how that sort of stuff might land quite quickly and efficiently?
You mean in-game?
Yeah, well, both actually, but firstly in-game, yeah.
Yeah, we don't have too much conflict in-game. I've never been in a huddle where there's been conflict between players in the huddle in front of the team. There can be, between two players on the run, whether maybe they wanted the ball or so something like that. But it's... I think there was one of Damien McKenzie and Anton Leonard-Brown that they showed in on Monday in review to take the piss a wee bit. But, they're like two of the bestest of mates, but they're getting stuck into each other on the field about something. And Anton's got having a crack at Damo, and Damo's saying, just calm down, mate. Like, that's all right, yeah. So that's probably those two different sort of personalities. coming to the fore under a wee bit of heat. But I think it's one of the great things about rugby and team sports in general, depending on the culture, is that the ability to have those honest conversations and know that it's not personal. Like, we can sit down. It happens in the leaders meeting probably a bit more because we're a little bit older and don't take things to heart, but we can seriously challenge or disagree with someone's comment, and it just stays there in that room. It's not, we realize that any challenge or any your thoughts or what you're thinking, you're only expressing them to try and better the team. It's not about having a crack at the individual. It's not a personal thing. And I think it's a pretty important life skill to be able to learn at a reasonably young age. You know, you've got young men in their 20s learning to take what some would consider criticism, but we just consider it feedback on board and move forward with it.
I guess that probably leads me into the next bit of, like, when you first came into the All Blacks, you were young, right? 20 years old. And so no doubt a lot of those players were playing when you were 14, 15 and just a kid. Mm. And then walking into the room and one thing and seeing them all there, but then getting that feedback from them, or even just, you know, I guess that feeling of imposter syndrome, or am I good enough to be here? You know, did you have all those fears and thoughts as a young player in that environment?
Yeah, 100%. I think you're spot on with, if you're a young fella and are lucky enough to make the All Blacks, even with Super Rugby, you know, as a young fella coming through, it was only a couple of years ago you're at high school watching these guys on TV and dreaming, a genuine dream to potentially play alongside them, and before you know it, you're there. So there's definitely that aura about those players. I remember my first training with the All Blacks. We went out and we just did a passing drill, hands, catch early, deliver. And I was just so nervous I was going to drop the ball, eh? Like, I just didn't know. I just remember thinking, like, why are you so effing nervous? It's just a passing drill. The fear, I think, is the fear of being judged, you know, if you did drop one. Now if I drop one, I'd just move on with it and flush it and not worry about it. But that initial fear of being judged, am I good enough? And you don't know that, I don't think, until you actually manage to get out and play your first test and match yourself at international footy. Yeah.
Do they do a good job, or I guess to you guys now, or did they when you were playing, do a good job of bringing the young fellas in? Because you do – I remember reading books as a kid about All Blacks and, you know, like there was the back of the bus sort of stuff. And, you know, like there was a real different, I don't know if it was a different culture, but it seemed like a real different culture of earn your stripes, boy, speak when you're spoken to. And I suspect that's changed now.
Yeah, it has changed. I reckon when I was first coming through, so that I was, I debuted in 2012 for the All Blacks, but 2011, my first year with the Chiefs, I was just getting this sort of back end of some of that old school stuff where there'd be guys on the team that, because I was wider training group for the Chiefs, that sort of wouldn't really talk to you or acknowledge you all season. Most of them were pretty good, but just some of those guys, and like, again, I've got nothing against those guys now because that was just the culture and the environment that they came through in. And that's how they were treated. So, and to be honest, I don't know why, maybe because I was a bit of a rugby tragic, you know, growing up. I was reading all these books that you've read, and probably, I'm assuming, a lot of these books, you know, those are the only books I was interested in reading as a kid were rugby books. So I was dead keen to just put my head down and work hard and never and earn respect, I think. That was the main thing I wanted to do. But you're certainly right, the culture has changed. To now, young guys, we want them to be able to come in, be comfortable, be themselves straight away, with the hope that they'll just go out and perform the best that they can without sort of fear of failure or being judged. So yeah, I think there's my opinion. There's honestly pros and cons to both. You know, the fact that to come in and you know, the first couple of years is purely just about earning respect on and off the field by your actions. You know, and that's all it was. And then, you know, but there's also massive cons to be able to come in and think, geez, this is an awesome environment. Like, I love it here. After your first couple of weeks, you're like, I just never want to leave. So I find we're in a tricky time where you're trying to get you still want to get a little bit of both.
Get a bit of that edge.
But there's still that, what you're talking, yeah, a little bit of that edge, you know. You don't want guys coming in and feeling too comfortable, but you want them to be able to enjoy it and be themselves. So, yeah, it's always a balancing act. But there's still that, what you talked about, the back of the bus, you know, from the front to the back. It's based on caps and years experience. So the old boys are at the back of the bus making their way all the way to the back seat. And often if we're going from a team meeting and the bus could be on the lower level and we're staying at a hotel, the meeting's on the top level, it's a bit of a race for the young fellas to get to the front because the management are at the front of the bus and then it's based off caps and it's often a little bit of a jam at the front of the bus, yeah. And no one wants to go back further than what they've earned.
Yeah. Nice. All that stuff's quite fun though, eh, I reckon, and building the culture, you know.
That's right, mate. And it's like when you finally do, you know, if you're lucky enough to be in the team for 2 or 3 years and all of a sudden you find yourself halfway down the bus and you see guys scrambling to get their seats at the front, you think, oh, yeah, that was me not long ago, and take a bit of pride and satisfaction of the years of work that you've done and to get your seat, I suppose, that you're in at the time.
Yeah. Tyler Wood, who is one of our best young golfers, actually, he's just posed a question. Do you still get nervous stepping out onto the field, or as soon as the first kickoff has been taken, do you tell yourself anything to keep yourself grounded?
Yeah, definitely still get nervous every game day. I'm just not great company. My wife will start to, like, she'll be like, why are you so snappy and stuff? And it's just like, I'm not interested in doing things or having meaningful conversations by any means. Sort of slowly, just subconsciously building up towards the game that night. So yeah, the nerves definitely kick in, but I think it's not that. I think you just learn to manage those nerves better and deal with them rather than letting them sort of overcome you and freak out that you're so damn nervous.
Yeah.
And then, you always take confidence from your. I take confidence from my week of preparation, knowing that I've got a really well planned, structured week where I've got lots of work in, and I can take confidence from that work that I'll go out and have a good performance. But I used to think feeling good on game day or just before kickoff would result in a good performance, but feeling good doesn't equate to good performance. Preparation equates to good performance, and if you're consistent with your preparation, then your performance will be the same. So look, when I run out, I will run out with a bit of a quite smile on my face, just to try not to forget how special it is to run out in front of a stadium full of fans cheering your team on. It's a pretty unique feeling. Now that I'm a special stage where I get to lead the boys out and turn around and they're running out behind me, try and enjoy that moment just before kickoff. Yeah.
What's it like being under Eden Park, like in the changing rooms? I was lucky enough to Golf New Zealand had a launch there one day, and so didn't get into the changing rooms or anything, but you see how massive that is when it's empty. And I can only imagine that sitting underneath that stadium where your bus pulls in, and you could feel like, I'm sure you guys are there a lot earlier than the crowd, but like 5 minutes before you run out, the noise must be just, do you hear it or do you feel it? down there?
I don't know. We love playing at Eden Park, partly because it's so familiar, you know, because we play there often. So, well, that's like big changing rooms. It feels, you know, like comfortable because you're something you're used to.
Yeah.
It's different to going overseas and maybe going to a stadium that you only go to once every 3 or 4 years. But to be honest, you don't really notice the noise. I think, or you feel it. Maybe you feel it a wee bit, just the energy. I think you feel energy in the air, and I certainly noticed that when we played in front of no crowds with COVID,
yeah,
the lack of energy in the air. Because yeah, if you get out on the field, you wouldn't often say, like, really notice the fans unless they're really belting it out.
Yeah.
And sometimes they do, and that's awesome. But, no, something about people and the energy that they everyone, a big group of people were together, yeah,
yeah,
the energy they put out.
Yeah, nice. When you're playing, do you have, I assume you've got clear metrics and goals, for lack of a better word, that you measure yourself on at the end of the day with your reflections or your reviews?
Yeah, so I won't have, every game pretty much just jot down normally three things that I want to focus on for that game, just to have them sort of front of mind. They're often like effort areas. Might be like getting off the ground quickly.
Yeah.
You know, like getting off the ground and getting set for your next task. That just bounce off the ground. So if you made a tackle, carried the ball, made a clean out, just get back on your feet as quickly as you can. There might be something that's technical in there that I've been trying to work on or refine. But I found that there's no point in me putting down five points, because I've done this in the past, five different points to focus on, and each one's about a sentence long. And then I'm on the bus thinking, what do I write down again? What am I focusing? Yeah, so just a couple of small things, and they're not specific by numbers, because it's a little bit, you can't have, the game can vary. It's not like I can go out there and say, I want to have 10 hard carries.
Yeah.
We might be defending for the majority of the game. We might end up making 20 tackles or something instead. So,
Do you reckon
small things?
Do you reckon that the stats that the coaches use are match up with, like, if you feel like, shit, I had a good game, are you almost will the metrics that the team use match up with your thoughts?
Yeah, generally. I've normally got a pretty good feel for how I've played and what areas of the game I've done well or not so well. And then it's just, confirming with stats and confirming through video. But there'll always be things that you've pictured them to play out in your head, how you've convinced yourself how it played out are different to how it actually did. And vice versa. Sometimes you picture how it went, and you often sort of, I don't know, reflect in your mind with images of what happened. And sometimes you can be spot on. So
yeah.
Combination of all three helps with you.
With the uniqueness of, I guess, the different positions and the different tasks and roles, like, you know, there's 15 positions and probably 15 different roles and maybe three or four coaches. Who do you go to, or in the past, even growing up, did anyone provide you with really good specific feedback around number seven roles, or is it just generic rugby roles?
I was pretty, up until the age of 16, didn't really have too much specific coaching. It was just rugby. But man, I was fortunate to have some pretty awesome coaches from a young age. And then I was fortunate to make the New Zealand under 17 squad as I might have been 16 years old. And there they had position specific coaches. So coaches that would just sit down with us and sort of, that was the first time I sort of thought, like, you know, what's the role and the definition of a open side flanker, and went from there.
Yeah.
And often, like, it doesn't change, you know, like, our flankers' core roles, clean rucks, attack the breakdown, tackle, run, support play. it's as simple as that. So you pretty much review and break your game down in those areas and work out where you're strong and where you need to get better at. Yeah.
You have been pretty lucky as well, with your career from a coaching point of view. You've had some pretty exceptional coaches. I'm probably thinking initially when you came into the Chiefs, you had a pretty cool group there. How much of a difference does that make having guys like that? And I guess probably if you're coaching at Super Rugby level, you are at that level as well. But those four in particular seemed pretty special.
Yeah, look, it's my second year at the Chiefs, and they're between Dave Rennie, Tom Coventry, Wayne Smith, and Andrew Strawbridge took over. And look, I didn't know too much different because I was such a young fella, wide-eyed, and we just thought, man, this is what it's all about. You know, these coaches are challenging us, making us think about the game. We had massive review sessions back then. So reviews as a team, as forwards, and then as individuals, we'd have to review our game. We had to learn to cut clips on the computer, and then we'd have to go and sit down with a coach and show them what we thought was good, what we're working on, why. So there's a lot of learning the game, learning your own game in those early years for me, and it was just so valuable. And again, just fortunate with timing. I think particularly in sports careers, timing has a lot to do with success sometimes, and timing can be completely out of your hands. You know, how many good players in your position at a certain time, you know, what coaches are coming through, what core group of players are coming through at any certain time. Just the timing of things can have a big impact on a career. And I was fortunate enough that the timing then was just, we won back-to-back titles with not the most talented teams by any means. If you look at them on paper, there's more talented teams. We had a team that worked really hard for each other. We trained really hard. And that was a great sort of base for us young fellas coming through to train so hard. And
do you still train hard, or are you just conditioned to it and you don't notice it now?
We train different. Like the way probably, and I think, I hope that coaches even then, but I know that some of us players have spoken about the way we trained in 2012 and 13 probably wasn't really sustainable for too many years. Like we had a lot of full-on sessions during the week. As a result, the competition within the squad was massive. If we guys didn't get named, they'd be pissed off and they'd be going out to training with a point to prove. But it probably wasn't quite sustainable. We still train hard, but it's a lot more science-based training these days. We've all got GPSs on our backs. It's all the running and the distance, the high-speed meters, like sort of like three-quarter pace is all measured and calculated and,
Do you enjoy that side of it?
Yeah. For a while there, I was sort of not against it, but I was like, had the attitude of, I know I'm training hard, so I don't need to look at these numbers and compare them to other guys. Like, I'll get nothing out of that. But I've sort of grown out of that stubborn attitude now and appreciate the numbers for what they are. And it just gives you a bit of an idea sometimes. You think a session's harder than it actually was. Like you feel buggered, but maybe you haven't done much running, which is probably a bit of a sign that you're a bit fatigued. So make sure, get some extra recovery sessions and really nail that. Or other times you're thinking, I felt great out there, and your numbers reflect that as well.
Yeah. There's a guy that sort of mentors me a little bit quite a lot actually, from a golf coaching point of view, but he's got a great saying that says, all stats really do is allow you to ask better questions, which I think you can get, certainly in golf, you can get caught up in a heap of data. But if you just look at it from that point of view, to give you some insight, that can help.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah.
Got a question here, and I haven't pre-read it, so it's a long one. From David Mays, being a Bayman through and through, you'll relate to this situation. The Steamers over the last decade have slipped from developing players from within its own province. We also lost three local coaches from Steamers coaching team to bring outsiders to run the program. Do you think our present model isn't helping players like you were 10 years ago? I worry that our True Bay culture has gone. What are your thoughts? And that might be a tough one for you to answer.
Yeah. Purely because I've probably got to be a little bit careful here. What is it? With Jay's podcast probably having such a wide reach, who knows who could be listening. And tomorrow I wake up with an article. It could be an article in the front of the Bay Times or back page with it. Look, I think there was a period, probably maybe 6 or 7 years ago, where it was purely just about developing players in our own region with minimal Super Rugby players. And the flow-on effect of that was that we're competing with teams that were made up of, you know, so you got your Super Rugby players, you might attend Cup, and then your club, you know, a rank below, a tier below. So when it came to Mitre 10, we had a whole bunch of club guys and academy boys stepping up to a big level, but a lot of these other teams had Super Rugby players coming down. So effectively, you've got guys who've been playing club and Super Rugby competing, which is, we just weren't, you know, the results spoke for themselves. I think Clayton McMillan brought some young guys up from Wellington that he coached in the under-19s. And we brought in guys from other areas, but they were young guys that were still needed developing. And it's only been in the last, my opinion, in the last 2 to 3 years that we've really, a lot of those guys have worked their way into Super Rugby squads, either via wider training group injury replacements and then working their way to full contracts. So you can view it two ways. Like, yeah, they might be, you know, stopping the pathway of some other guys, but you'd hope that if the Bay recruits smartly, they only recruit in areas they don't see, you know, young guys coming through in those positions, you know, sort of filling the void of what you think the Steamers team can look like in 2, 3, 4 years time. So yeah, I know we've got a lot of Super Rugby players now. I know with COVID it's really affected and last year's budgets cut, it's affected the academy big time, which only time will tell, because it's been impressive to see the Bay Plenty under-19s team perform so well for the last few years. I've seen a few of those guys come through, but yeah, the last thing you really want is that genuine local talent being blocked. So
yeah,
well, that's all part of the recruitment and the coaching.
Yeah,
well above what I deal with.
And I guess in many ways, though, it's also the other side of it is it's good for the young fellas. Like, imagine how cool it is for a young guy to come in and have, you know, be at a training where you're playing, or you know, I guess in future years, Caleb Trask, or like, that must be cool for the young players for their development too, even if you are from outside of the region.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, to what, we finished third last year. So yeah, and the team's building. So yeah, it's cool for young guys to come in and train with Super Rugby players, get a real kick and learn a lot out of that. And then also, you know, hopefully aspire to be part of a team that's competing at the top of the Mitre 10 Cup, really challenging for a premiership.
It's been good the last few years. I've, you know, like, I guess, I don't know whether it coincided with COVID, but getting big crowds to Tauranga Domain, you know, in the Bay, I've always played a really good style of rugby, I reckon, you know, like an enjoyable style to watch. When it comes off, it's brilliant. When it doesn't, you get a bit pissed off. But I thought last year, particularly, you know, there's some massive crowds at the game, some close games. I reckon it's been awesome for the NPC or Mitre 10. I'm not sure what it's called now, unfortunately.
I think it's called Bunnings now. Might be the Bunnings now. Bunnings. Yeah. Oh, I agree. I think it that up the Tauranga Domain suits the Bay too, because there's no lights. We have to play in the afternoon.
Yeah.
You know, dry pill, dry track.
Yeah.
I think everyone will remember the game that the Bay pumped Canterbury there this year. That was last year. That was outstanding. So I think the more, and I reckon unions are starting to realise that the more that they can take the games to those smaller grounds, the better the experience for the fans.
There's a question's popped up, but I just want to touch on one thing there. What's the difference like, from Bay to Chiefs to All Blacks? Mike Rogers, I think, who coached with the Bay last year, he went up to the one of your tests at Eden Park, one of the All Blacks tests, and I remember him saying, he's like, man, the collisions are unbelievable. I said to him, surely, you coach Mitre 10 Cup, mate, surely you see that every week. And he said, no, it's just it's like about 10 levels up. Is that what you notice as a player? Like, I was surprised that a coach like him was surprised at the intensity level.
It cranks up every level. And the speed of Test rugby is fast. You got to be accurate at Test level, like in all areas. And it's physical, but it's awesome too. Like, it's one, when you're surrounded by even better players every level you go, whether it's from club to Bunnings to the Mitre 10, whatever, from club to provincial to Super Rugby and then to Test, it's all just a step up, and it steps up, but so do the players around you. And in a funny way, you lift as well. And it's, everything happens slightly quicker and harder because those guys are better players as well. And you either adjust or you go with it, or you don't.
You don't go with it.
Question
here from Michael Smith. How much of your pre-game preparation is opposition-specific strategy versus working on bringing your preferred best team style to the match?
I'd say 70-30 in favour of focusing on ourselves and what we put out there. You can assume what a team's going to bring and do your homework, which is helpful. But it can be detrimental if you focus too much on the opposition and what you think they're going to do, and then they bring and you anticipate that's what they're going to do, and they do something different. So we can assume stuff, but we have to go out there and you confirm it by what you see. So I think doing a little bit of analysis on the opposition sort of gives you a little bit of confidence, takes that unknown a little bit out of it. Took the last couple of years playing just the Kiwi teams, you don't have to do quite as much analysis because we've been playing each other so much. But I'm not personally a big, I don't enjoy sitting down and watching hours of footage. I'll just do what I need to, and I've sort of over the years managed to narrow that down to just what I need to get. I think some of the backs, they'll have to do, backs and line-out boys, the line-out forwards, they have to do a wee bit more.
Do you, you must pick up on physical cues of players, like, let's say you notice Bowden Barrett standing in a certain way, and when he just stands like that, he often picks it, or he often runs. My first question is, is that a fair reflection? And the second question is, at what point do you tell him? Because if you're playing for the Chiefs, you don't want him to know, but if you're playing for the All Blacks, it might be quite useful that he knows.
When Bodie first started out, he used to face the sideline pretty much when he was going to pass the ball. He used to get real side on, and we used to know that. And if he straightened up, he was pretty much going to run. After a couple of years, because we're the same age, we come through the age group stuff together as well, so we're pretty good mates. We ended up telling him, he's like, oh, shit, that's good to know. I think, guys who are steppers have good footwork, but predominantly normally have a side that they step off. Some of them will have a side that they step off, and some they'll sort of goosey and try to go the outside. It's good to know. Good to know things like that. Like Israel Folau used to only step off his left foot, I think. Yeah. Can't remember that. Yeah. Things like that. But you don't get, try not to get too caught up in it. But, and just little hints here and there help. And yeah, just reading body language and body shape. Yeah. Just comes with experience.
Tyler Woods asked, do you ever find yourself lacking confidence at times or questioning in your own ability, maybe after a not so satisfying performance? And if so, what sort of things do you do to pull yourself back from that frame of mind? Do you look to try and gather information from it or just try and forget about it?
So don't just try. I wouldn't just try, forget about it. But I would view it, take it for what it is, in terms of I wouldn't overthink it. If it's one game, I'm not going to dwell on that too much, but I am going to focus down on what areas I wasn't happy with and what I can do better. I've always been pretty good at backing myself. And I think part of that comes from, like I touched on earlier, getting the confidence of the work that I put in. Like if I hadn't done the extra stuff after training, I'll plan my week at the start of the week and I can sit down on a Friday night, the night before the game, and look at all this work on a piece of paper. Yeah, I've done all that work. I know, like, I'm mentally and physically ready. I've given myself every chance to go out and play well and then take confidence from that. If I hadn't have done that if I'd happened to cut corners in different areas and cheated myself, then yeah, I probably wouldn't feel as confident. But if in a bit of a rut or wasn't happy with how I was going, it wouldn't be about changing things drastically, about trusting the process and the work. And sometimes going back to just focusing on what you're good at. If there's a few things that aren't going well, like what are the one or two things that you're really good at? You just go out and focus on doing them really well. And it's funny how the positive effect it has once you do a few good things well, other things start to happen well. But we even saw it with the Chiefs team this year. We get a win and all of a sudden other good things start to happen from it. It's a funny thing, sport, yeah.
That there was about 15 minutes in that Hurricanes match, eh, in the first round of the Aotearoa Cup. And the Chiefs were getting hammered at halftime, and then they had 15 minutes where they pretty much won that match, and then from there it was a different team.
Yeah, that's right. And it's that comp is the smallest of margins, as we all saw from watching.
One thing I did want to talk about, mate, because I reckon it must have been hard for you, obviously, but also must have been amazingly hard for Harriet when you were injured in South Africa with your neck injury.
Yeah.
I guess there's a few things there. Like, obviously, physically that's hard because you broke your neck, so that's got to be tough. And there's the confidence coming back to bloody hurl yourself at rucks again. Must have been tough. How hard was it emotionally right at the start there? Like, you know, you're in South Africa. I think your mum and Harriet ended up coming over, but for a while there, you're just in a hospital in South Africa. How tough was that?
It wasn't too bad, to be honest. Like, I'm pretty, I don't know. I look at I'm glass half full with so many things. It's just, things could be real rough and I'll still, like, it's just the way I am. I'll be like, it's not too bad. I could be worse. Things can always be worse, I feel. So, it sucked. It was a real shock when they came in and told me I'd broken my neck because I didn't know. I had scans and was sitting there or lying there in the bed. I was in a lot of pain, but I didn't even have a neck brace on at the stage. And then the doctors and nurses rushed in. There's about five or six of them, put this brace on me, start rubbing their fingers up my foot, make sure I could feel my feet. And it was at that moment, they're like, oh, you've broken your neck. Jeez, like, did not expect that. So that was that initial shock. They quickly followed that up with, but you're going to be okay.
Right.
And I think because I never lost feeling in any of my legs or arms. I could walk. And then you're in the care of the professionals. You never sort of fear. I didn't feel like I was ever going to go backwards from where I was.
Mm.
And then I think that first night was pretty, pretty tough, to be honest. It was probably one of the worst nights I've had in my life. Yeah. Just in so much pain. And in a hospital in South Africa, and it was a rough night.
Yeah.
But once I had surgery and woke up from that, they told me that I'd be able to get back playing rugby again. And from there, it was just like, to be honest, I was extremely grateful that I was going to be okay.
Yeah.
And even if that meant not playing rugby again, I was still, you know, just extremely grateful that I was going to be all right and be able to live a normal life. So that's the attitude I had. And if there was times during my rehab, because I had to have a neck brace on for 3 months, if there was times during that I started to get sick of that or frustrated, it was pretty easy. I just reminded myself, at least I'm standing up and walking around, and I can stand up and make my own breakfast, do things like this. And yeah, when you have an attitude like that, and looking at the positive side, it's not too bad.
Yeah. And in terms of coming back to the game, was it, in my head, it would have been bloody harrowing trying to think about making a tackle, but listening to your talk there, it sounds like it was just another injury. You're just going to go through the process.
Look, if I allowed, and even now, if I allow myself to think about what could have been and how close, because it was a fractured dislocation, so I broke my vertebrae in two places, and then that piece dislodged forward. Yeah, if I think about how close and lucky I am, and then it's not nice to think like that. So I don't really allow myself to think like that too much. But then also know that the medical advice that I've received is world class, and I've got two vertebrae fused together. So technically, my neck's actually stronger than it was to start with.
Yeah,
it was a freak accident, and I love this game, so I'm not going to give it up based off a fear that it could happen again. Where I've actually got just as much chance as someone out there who hasn't probably listening up because it's fused together, and someone who's out there playing now. So yeah, all the little hurdles along the way, from taking the brace off to moving it to the first time I fell on the ground, because you've had 3 months of just protecting yourself, to all these little baby steps that I had to progressing my contact and strengthening my neck right up until the day that I got back out there playing rugby, they were all little milestones, and they were all little mental challenges in their own right. Yeah. Thinking, am I going to be okay? Am I going to be okay? You do it a few times. I am. Sweet. Move on to the next thing.
Mm. Yeah. Nice. Just a couple of things, mate, to finish. Just hearing you talk about there, if rugby didn't, if you couldn't play again, do you have any, I guess you must do career planning and stuff outside of rugby. Do you think coaching's something they'd get into?
No, probably not, to be honest. For the reasons being that, I touched on the analysis work on the computers. I'm not big on that, and they do a lot of analysis, the coaches. But also, I just feel like I'd want to do something a little bit different, because if I went transitioned into coaching, I'd sort of be running off a similar schedule that I've been running off for the last 10, potentially 15 years, depending how long I get to play. Potentially traveling to the same countries and something similar, just in a different role. So I don't think that's what I want to do, but I love the game. So I feel like I've would have accumulated a wee bit of knowledge around not just the game of rugby, but how the dynamics of teams, how they function, how to get the best out of players, and leadership roles as well. So I'd still like to be involved in some capacity. But hopefully that's a few years off. But I do like the idea of maybe working with younger players a wee bit before they, guys that are on this sort of verge of potentially trying to make a career out of it. I feel like you could have a real positive influence on some of them.
That sort of leads to my next question. I guess I'll actually reframe it to, how do you think you could have a positive influence? And the actual question I was going to ask was, you know, for all the school first 15 players out there that are, you know, say they're all listening to you right now, which both of them are, what advice would you give them? They're, you know, they're, let's say they're all aspirational, they all want to play for higher levels.
One school, one trait that I think is hugely valuable is to be coachable. And what I mean by that is to have the ability to take advice on board or take coaching on board, feedback on board, and be able to implement it into your game or whatever you're practicing. And you'd think that the further up the ranks you go, the guys would be a little bit more shut off. The further up you go, guys are just wanting feedback from everywhere. Every tackle they do with their mate on a pad, they're looking for feedback. What went well there? How can I do it better? So, but I think back to when I was at first 15, guys who would blame others if they dropped the ball when it was a perfect pass. You know, like being able to look at yourself honestly, be coachable, but also, what's the word I'm looking for? Like self-awareness. Have strong self-awareness.
Yeah.
Do you think you can grow those traits? Can you grow those traits?
Yeah. Do you think you can become self-aware if you weren't, or become coachable if you're not?
Of course. I think any traits can be grown and developed. But the first point is, like if you're willing to, if you're not self-aware, you've got to be willing to hear it from someone else and maybe accept that you're not right and they are. And if you hear it from enough people, but you may not hear it from many people either, because there's not too many people out there that are willing to tell other people what they think about them sometimes. So those two traits, so self-awareness, coachable. Like that's obvious. I think if you love the game and you love the sport, what do you love about it? That'll help. But then also being really disciplined, and people can use like work ethic or motivated, but I think discipline is, be disciplined is the key word. Disciplined in your training habits and all sorts of, just disciplined in life to put you in good stead.
I lied about the last question, mate, because I just thought of another one that I desperately did want to ask you. And then I'll let you go.
You're done. You've burnt it now, yeah.
You know those days where most of us wake up and we had plans of going to the gym and we look at the alarm clock and go, oh, no, fuck it, I'll just sleep in a little bit longer and I'll go tomorrow. The assumption is that people like you don't have those days and those feelings. But then I'm probably smart enough to know that there's days where you actually just don't feel like doing it, but you still do it. How do you push through that space? Like, what do you reckon? Because I reckon that's one of the key differences between good and great.
Yeah, so that would be the exact definition of, I suppose I didn't frame it very well, but what I mean by being disciplined.
Yeah.
You know, to go out, get up and do that, even though you don't feel like it, because 100%, like, top athletes are exactly the same. There's days that they don't feel like doing those things.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing for me is I just feel like I've let myself down if I don't do that. If I don't do it, I feel worse.
Yeah,
I just feel worse that if I let myself down. I feel worse if I ever say I was a fitness drill, I don't do it. But if I was to not do one of the blocks or cut one of the reps, like it wouldn't matter if no one was watching. I'd feel shit about that. I wouldn't. Yeah, and I think my belief is that if you start cutting a corner on a small thing once or twice, then in your own mind that'll become acceptable to you, and then you'll start doing a little bit more, and before you know it, you've created this habit or this tendency to cut corners or take the easy option.
Yeah.
Whereas I've just got this attitude of like, if it says this is how much running you've got to do, then I'm doing that. If this is how many reps it is, even if no one's there, I'm not cutting it short. because I don't want to breed that or develop those tendencies.
Oh, that's outstanding. I'm glad I got that last one in. Oh, thanks Sweet. Heaps for that, man.
Pleasure, Jay.
Love your work.
Thanks, mate. You too. Okay.
Yeah, we'll catch you.